Ladies and gentlemen, can I welcome you to this, the second of this year's Lionel Robbins Memorial Lectures. Will Baumol was introduced to you at the beginning of Lecture 1, and I have no intention of repeating that introduction, which always seemed to me a bit like premature obituaries. So, without more ado, can I invite Will to lecture to us on win-lose, win-win, and lose-lose scenarios.
Thank you. I see that many of you have not had punishment enough and have ventured to return. You know, Thorstein Veblen used to believe that there was virtue in keeping audiences small. So in the first of a series of lectures, he would always begin by speaking in a whisper so that only people in the first two rows could hear him. Obviously, I did not speak softly enough, but I'm very grateful to all of you for returning. Incidentally, I was criticized yesterday for having sat rather than standing during my presentation. My fear is that today the criticisms will be rather more severe, but at least there is one thing I can cure rather easily. I ended yesterday's talk with a depiction of a world trade pattern characterized by industries with high startup costs, so that those countries that are in a position to achieve a high share of the market in those commodities are also in a position to retain it, because it is so hard for others to get in. And I showed that this removed the certainties supposedly contributed undeviatingly by the market mechanism, the pressures which always drove the world toward utmost efficiency and mutual gains from trade. I showed how instead one ended up with a broad range of possibilities among which the market would select, perhaps largely by historical happenstance, leaving the market mechanism with literally millions of possible outcomes instead of one. And to do extreme violence to a metaphor, thereby restoring free will to the invisible hand. The mind, if I may say so, is staggered by the vast number of equilibria, what they can mean, how one can deal with them, how one can discern anything from the profusion of possibilities. But I hope to show now that in fact one can reduce them to order, and not only reduce them to an orderly pattern, but one which is, we think, profoundly illuminating and at worst at least suggestive. That, however, requires, I asked your patience yesterday, and I will ask it again for the next 10 minutes today, because in order to do this, I need an instrument, and Ralph Gummery has invented that instrument. It is a graph with whose aid one can represent these millions of equilibria. Now, the problem that you have to recognize is at the center of all this, of the difficulty of doing this, is that as I described it yesterday, knowing an equilibrium gives us much too much information. That is, an equilibrium I described as a 5-year plan in which one has thousands of output quantities, so many shoes, so many pots, so many automobiles. One has prices for each. One has purchases in the different countries. So for each one of the equilibria, one has thousands of numbers. How can you use a single point to represent those thousands of numbers? Well, you can't, of course. But you can do something to give you some sense of what those numbers are. And we all know what we do about it. In fact, GDP, or whatever measure of national income you use, is the standard way, the best invention we have been able to come up with to represent what an equilibrium is. That is to say, GDP is the summation, the embodiment of all the quantities of output and their prices, the best we can do to use one number to represent all those quantities and prices. And in principle, you can do that in a very simple way, though of course the actual calculations are far from simple. What we are dealing with is a supply-demand mechanism of the elementary textbook variety, a set of supply and demand curves for each commodity, of course interrelated, but nevertheless, for each commodity, a supply and demand curve. And by finding out where the intersection of those two curves occurs, you know for each quantity how much will be purchased and what price. Knowing for each commodity how much will be purchased and at what price, we immediately know the market value of what has been produced. We add this up for all the commodities together, and that is basically what we mean by GDP, our index of all of the vast number of components of the equilibrium. So what we're doing is what we hope that every first-year student learns, that is, that we are dealing with market equilibria and that there is a macroeconomic convention which enables us to sum up the elements of that equilibrium. And so I'm going to be focusing in our graph on the GDP, and I'm going to be using it in two ways. But before I do that, I may say that this is a little bit of a distortion of what we actually do. Because in our calculations, it is all expressed not in terms of GDP, but in terms of a utility function for the economy. We happen to use for convenience in calculation what is called a Cobb-Douglas utility function, but it is still proper to think of that as a particular one of the many indices of GDP that one can construct. It just is a particular mathematical expression for GDP. So even though I am slightly misrepresenting what we did, it is not a substantive distortion. Now, I've said we're going to need two representations of GDP, and that is because I am dealing with trade between two countries. So what I'm going to use is both absolute GDP and relative GDP. That is to say, I'm going to reduce French and British GDP to a common currency, say dollars, to make it irrelevant to both of them. And then I am going to say, all right, suppose that the British GDP is 10 trillion and the French GDP is 20 trillion, then the share, the UK share, is 33 1/3%. I mean, that's arithmetic so simple that even I can follow it. And no joke, those who know me know that I'm being serious. But so these are two numbers that we will need, and I want to distinguish carefully between them. I mean, they sound as though they're just a simple arithmetic transformation, and in a sense they are, but their meaning and their information is very different. For example, we know that if we take absolute British GDP, in the course of a century, that has more than trebled. But if you compare British per capita GDP with French per capita GDP over the course of a century, that has fallen by between 50% and 75%. So that you can have a rise in one, a fall in the other, vice versa. They're very different things. One tells us what quantity of goods and services are available for an average resident of these isles, and the other tell us how that compares with what is available to a person in the other country. And we can now see how I construct the graph, because what I'm going to do is, let's see, can people see this? Well, you can't if I stand in front of it, but
you could always sit down and do this.
Yeah, okay, why don't I do it that way? Revert to my seated position. You see, what we have here is on the bottom of the graph, I have the relative UK income, that is, the UK share going from 0% at the left to 100% at the right, meaning that at the right-hand end, the French share is 0, and at the left-hand end, the French share is 100%. And on the vertical axis, I have absolute income. In this case, I'm dealing only with the UK. We'll bring in France in a few moments. But what we see here is point D is a typical equilibrium point. It is an equilibrium point at which the UK has 40% of the income of the two countries, and hence France has 60%, and in which the absolute GDP of Great Britain is $8 trillion, measured in this international fictitious currency. So, and point E is another possible equilibrium point, again, giving for that equilibrium point two pieces of information, relative income and absolute income. Height is absolute income, right to left is relative income. Now, one might have thought that once we drew out all the equilibrium dots, that they would form a meaningless pattern, perhaps something like this, with equilibrium points all over the place, having no particular way of being described and no discernible implications. But in fact, this is not what we find. Both by experiment, that is actually running calculations in case after case after case, and by the logic which I will explain to you, it turns out that the form of the graph, and this is an actual calculated graph, is this. This, I believe, is for 11 commodities and two countries. Each of the dots in the area between the two curves is a different one of the possible equilibrium points. You see, the market no longer has one outcome which it is toward which it is driven. It can end up in any one of those points. And you can already see that there is a story here. First of all, the story, just graphically, is that the region of equilibrium points, because they do always trace out a region of this shape, is roughly crescent-shaped, with the highest point in the somewhere in the center. You also see that there are some points where absolute income is very low, close to zero at the left-hand end, points in the middle at which absolute income is very high, and points on the right at which it starts declining again. And just to pique your curiosity before I go into details, you see what's happening on the bottom axis as you go from left to right. The UK is getting a larger and larger share of the world income, the world consisting of two countries in this model, England and France. But as you would expect, its absolute income is rising correspondingly. So far, nothing surprising. But what this says is you can get too greedy. You can go too far. If you get too large a share of the world's income, instead of becoming wealthier, instead of having more cars, more television sets, more concerts, you end up at lower points. Your absolute income falls. And it is in this shape that the main lessons of the analysis derive. Now, it should not surprise you that when you calculate the graph for France, you are going to get a picture that is very similar. It is dissimilar in only one respect. Here is our calculation for France, and you see it's the same sort of distorted crescent shape. However, the peak lies rather more to the left of the diagram than the UK graph, but that's merely an artificial result of the way we have drawn the graphs. Remember, in both graphs, I keep the bottom axis the same. That is, I measure not France's share of world income, but UK share of world income, because I know if I know one, I automatically know the other. If the French income is 25%, even my arithmetic tells me that the UK income is 75%. so that in looking at the UK graph, rising share means going from left to right, but if I look at the French graph, rising share means going from right to left, as though we were reading Hebrew rather than English. But that's merely a way, you see, I want to make the two graphs comparable, that's why I have kept the same bottom axis. It is a matter of convenience, I don't have to draw it that way. And all that says, that is the fact that the UK peak is to the right of the French peak, is, look, naturally we would expect the UK income to be high when it has absolute income to be high, where it has a fairly high share of world income. That is towards the right of the diagram. And the French absolute income to be highest where it has a relatively high share, that is to the left of the diagram, because we're measuring French relative income from the 100 toward 0 and the UK from 0 toward 100. So these are the basic graphs, and what you have seen immediately is what I promised you yesterday, that these equilibria do not fall haphazardly throughout the diagram. They are not sort of random locations. Rather, they align themselves in a systematic and orderly pattern always. Not only a systematic and orderly pattern, but one can calculate, and Ralph Gomery tomorrow will give us some indication of how we do this. We can calculate an upper boundary and a lower boundary for these dots. I've depicted them in both graphs. And those boundaries are pretty well defined because we have the following result, which we have proven. And that is that as you get more and more commodities, the number of dots not only increase, but fill up the space in the following sense. Pick any space, any point in this space. Then if you increase the number of commodities sufficiently, you will find an equilibrium point within a millimeter of that point, or whatever distance you want. They will crowd in and fill up the space, and not only fill up the space, but fill up the space all the way up to the boundaries, both upper and lower. So that this region isn't just, the two boundaries aren't just a loose depiction of roughly where the points lie, they are the region of equilibrium points. All of them are there. All of the specialized equilibria are there. There are no specialized equilibria above the upper boundary, none below the lower boundary, and incidentally, there are unspecialized equilibria which may be below the lower boundary, but never above the top one. So those boundaries are firm constructs which are approached by the equilibrium points, filled in, and the region is covered by them. Now, so that's the first surprising feature. Yesterday the surprise was the sheer number of these things. Today's surprise is that they line up, what was it that Lincoln Stephen said, like little puppies waiting to have their heads patted, I mean, in a nice, neat, and orderly manner. Now, we can go further and start asking, Why does this graph always look this way, and what does it tell us? First, you have to recognize that as you move from left to right, not only is the share of UK income increasing, but in fact the share of UK industries is increasing. What do I mean by that? Remember, yesterday I contrasted the world with startup costs with the Ricardian world. In the Ricardian world, if you lose one industry, you gain another because of comparative advantage. Here, yesterday, I showed that that simply does not happen with scale economies. Once you become the largest producer of commodity X, you keep commodity X until an enormous effort is made by the other country. So if you collect X and Y and Z, see, I taught here once, I don't say Z when I'm here, then as you collect more and more of them, you retain them. So it is not surprising, and in fact this is true, that as you move from left to right, as England gets more and more of the world's GDP, the percentage, it also becomes the proprietor of more and more commodities. France is driven out of the production of an increasing number of commodities, and these are gathered up by British industry. And of course, the reverse happens if you go from right to left. Second, as you move from toward the center, which incidentally you can show also contains the sort of the what we have called the classical point, it's a rough approximation of the classical equilibrium, you do approach an efficiency arrangement in the following two senses. Number one, you don't have one country with 500 products and the other country with 3 products, because if you have 500 products and you've divided your labor force among them, each of them must be produced on a fairly small scale, and therefore you've lost your economies of scale at one of the edges. That is, at the right edge, England has most of the products and therefore has divided its labor force among the bulk of the commodities that the world produces. At the left-hand end, France has the bulk of the products and therefore has over-divided its labor force among them. And so it is only in the middle that scale economies can accrue effectively to both countries. More than that, toward the right-hand end, or toward the left-hand end, the winner country, if we may think of it that way for a moment, has acquired for itself commodities that it is very ill-suited to produce. England ends up producing mangoes and exotic tropical fruits. Ralph hates those examples because they have nothing to do with scale economies, but I'm trying to make a different point here, that when England has garnered the world's exclusive production of the bulk of the world's commodities, it will be producing things that the Isle of Skye is not well suited to make. And the reverse happens at the left-hand end, where the French are producing many commodities of which they are poor producers. So it is only in the middle that you can get specialization in which each country does what comes naturally, does what it does best. And it is only in the middle that no country has so fractionated its labor force, assigning 5 workers to commodity A and 3 workers to commodity B, I exaggerate to make the point, so that that scale economies are lost. What does that mean? The old hoary cliche, world income as a growing pie, if you think of it that way, the pie is biggest in the middle. It gets very small at either end because countries are producing things they shouldn't, in some sense, be producing, and because economies of scale have been lost. Now, these are the main observations you need to understand what is happening here. Let's go back to the UK diagram. Just a little more natural to speak of going from left to right rather than right to left. And what happens here is that as you go from left to right, by definition, the UK share of the pie is increasing. And, as I just explained, the pie itself is growing. So as you go from left to right, England benefits in 2 ways. The pie grows and it gets a bigger share. We're moving from the left-hand side to the middle. As you move there, you get the advantages of specialization, of the right specialization. You get the advantages of scale economies. So the economy is capable of producing more cars, more computers, more TV sets, and even more mangoes. So England, living in a world which is wealthier and getting a bigger share of that wealth, naturally benefits, and that is why the graph goes uphill for quite a while. You can now guess the rest of the story, because beyond some point, while England's share continues to grow, the size of the pie necessarily declines, and declines so much that ultimately the UK, even though growing in relative wealth, finds that it is sacrificing standard of living, absolute income. How far does this curve descend? Well, at the left-hand end, it's quite obvious that it's got to start out at zero. When you have zero relative income, presumably you have zero absolute income as well. So at the left-hand end, this curve is always anchored at the zero point, at the origin. At the right-hand end, it moves towards a point which I have labeled ought U for UK, and ought for autarky. Why? Well, think of what has happened. As you move from left to right, more and more of the world's industries fall into the lap of the UK producers, and fewer and fewer are therefore imported, our goods imported from France. In fact, by definition, at the right-hand end, England is making everything and importing nothing from France. And that, of course, is what we mean by autarky. That is, at the right-hand end of the graph, always we have the level of absolute income which England, which the UK economy can achieve for itself, totally, if totally deprived of the benefits of world trade. And you get, of course, exactly the corresponding picture for France, where the curves end up at point aught F, autarky for France. And you can see immediately two things that I had described yesterday. Number one, there are many equilibria that offer gains from trade, because the autarky points are, of course, the points of no trade, and any point that offers you a GDP higher than that means you have gained from trade. So anything that lies roughly above this orange line is an equilibrium point in which the UK absolute income is greater than it would be in autarky, and England has gained from trade. But there are also equilibria right in here, many of them, all of them, with incomes for the UK lower than at autarky. And this illustrates the other point I made yesterday, that not only can the market mechanism in a world of startup costs and scale economies offer you outcomes worse than the most efficient one, which would be somewhere up here. I mean, all these outcomes are better than autarky, but far from the Ricardian ideal. It can actually leave the UK stuck in an equilibrium point in here, in which it is worse off than if it had sealed itself off entirely from trade. And what I have emphasized yesterday is that all these points are stable. Once you are trapped in them, you can get out, but not by little experimental steps. You, because of high startup costs, because of economies of scale, you can only get out of them by breaking into industries in which that equilibrium point has denied you participation, and you can only get into such industries by operating on a large scale, because in this world, small is expensive. Small cannot compete with large. So we see here how these equilibria, why these equilibria involves better and better outcomes for England as you move from left to right, why they reach a maximum, and then you can see now why they start going downhill again, because the pie starts shrinking, because you get into the region of production inefficiency. That means that even if England remains the giant producer of the world, it is the giant producer in a world of 16th, 17th century standards of living, not in the standards of living of the 20th century. Now, so far I have shown the two countries separately, but we can go one more step and show how these two countries' equilibrium regions compare. And you do that by essentially taking the two graphs, making sure they're transparent, as I carefully arranged these to be, and then simply putting them on top of one another. I won't bother doing that because my secretary has already done it for me in one combined graph. For easier visibility, we've put in the dots for the UK, but who cares? We've left them out for the French. So we see here the upper income frontier for France, the lower income frontier for France, the upper income frontier for the UK, the lower income frontier for the UK. And you see, as you saw before, that they have this, they make, each makes a crescent, each pair makes a crescent shaped region, that the two regions overlap, and characteristically, that the French peak, point F, lies to the left of the UK point peak U. I already indicated why, but let me quickly recapitulate. What's happening, of course, is as you move to the right, the UK share of world income, by definition, is increasing, and the French share is, by definition, decreasing. And, of course, we would expect that at least for a while, that would be beneficial to France, but to England, but not to France. So this is the characteristic shape of the two curves. And then we see from that something very significant. I have divided the graph into three regions. A shaded region on the left, an unshaded region in the middle, and a shaded region on the right. What graphically the difference of among those regions is that in the middle region, the French curves are going downhill toward the right, whereas the UK curves are going uphill. In the left region, both the French and the English boundaries are going uphill. In the right-hand region, both of them are going downhill. What does that mean? It means that the left and the right-hand regions are regions where there are gains not from trade, there are too, but gains from cooperation. Whereas the middle range is the range of rivalry. That is, the middle range is the range of competition between France and Germany, the United States and Japan. The right and left hand ranges are the ranges that describe, say, the relationship between the United States and Mexico. What do I mean? Well, what happens if you go from the point marked 40 to the point marked 60 on the horizontal axis? The UK share of world income is increasing from 40 to 60%. That raises the wealth of Great Britain and depresses the wealth of France. It says, you are in a beggar, my neighbor, world, because the way the UK can benefit will always be at the expense of someone else. On the other hand, in the left-hand end, or in the right-hand end, because the curves are all going in the same direction, there both countries can benefit. If we go from the point marked, say, 80 to the imaginary point, not, well, let me do it, to the point marked 90, or rather vice versa. Let's say the world is at the point marked 90, and you go back toward the point marked 80, and now imagine the two countries being Mexico and the United States rather than the UK and France. I mean, pick any industrialized and unindustrialized country. What you see is that by moving from the point marked 90 to the point marked 80, not only does Mexico gain, the country that has the small number of scale economies industries, but the United States gains as well. The paradox is that the United States becomes richer by losing industries deliberately to Mexico. This is the region of cooperation. It is the region of the enlightened selfishness of the Marshall Plan, which benefited the United States by helping the Europeans to increase their GDP. And it is that same enlightened selfishness that can help all of us industrialized countries today by making better customers and giving to the less developed countries those products which ultimately they are in a better position to produce than we who have captured them for ourselves. So you see that the graph shows us a number of things aside from the orderliness of the many equilibrium points, which at least I do not recognize from any of the previous literature. We have already seen the many, many possibilities that I have never seen recognized before. We see the orderliness of those, the pattern that those outcomes produce, which I certainly have never seen mentioned before. We see the pattern of systematic acquisition and loss of industries that can occur in such a world, and which is an impossibility in a Ricardian world of scale diseconomies ruled by comparative advantage. And we have seen that there are opportunities previously unrecognized for mutual cooperation, but also sources of rivalry, which the literature also does not recognize and cannot, if it deals to the extent that it deals with scale diseconomies, because the rivalry is over the acquisition of industries, which cannot happen in a scale diseconomies world as long as comparative advantages do not change. So, as I say, this analysis goes from the pure abstraction of depiction of equilibrium points and graphs to a number of insights about reality. Let me keep it just for a few moments. This is no criticism of the previous literature. It was just not in a position to recognize. Now, there are many implications of all this. I'm not going to, I've almost gone through my hour, and that the timing I find not too bad. But so I will not repeat the implications that with which I started yesterday, because most of them I have already reviewed today in terms of the graphs. But there is one point that is central to all this. You know, we have long ago learned that the market mechanism is a wonderful thing, that it is able to accomplish wonders in terms of productivity, rising standards of living that have never been advertised more fervently than they were by Karl Marx in those purple passages in the Communist Manifesto, in which he tells us about what the bourgeoisie has been able to accomplish in its 100 years of existence, as he describes it, for far outstripping Gothic cathedrals and ancient pyramids and so on. But we have also learned that the market doesn't do everything. It doesn't cure AIDS or baldness. It does not clean windows. And its more better known shortcomings are those connected with monopoly, externalities, the business cycle, unemployment, inflation. We've heard all of those. What this analysis tells us is not that we should sneer at the market. Quite the contrary, we believe strongly that the market is used where it is best, should be encouraged, fostered, and certainly allowed to function. But it does say there is one danger that was not previously recognized. It is an addition to the list of things to watch out for, because it says that while in a world of no startup costs and scaled diseconomies, the invisible hand drives you unerringly towards the most efficient apportionment of industries among the countries of the world. In the case of startup costs and scale economies, it may well lead to losses from trade. It can well lead to disparities in the benefits to the trading countries. It can well create rivalries, which the common man and woman has long recognized, but which the economic literature has tended not to emphasize. So the first broad implication is that laissez-faire continues to have much to be said for it, but there is now to be recognized yet one more in the list of perils for which we must watch out when we let it work for itself. The second point is that if the market, by happenstance, gets us to something like this, to a point which is extremely disadvantageous, we cannot say in advance that the market, having gotten us into this mess, will get us out of it, because these are locally stable equilibria. Here, the government may have to play a part. And my final word here is that it is customary to say that where government intervenes, we are merely asking for trouble because bureaucrats do not know what business people know about where appropriate investments should take place, which industries should be encouraged, etc. All this lore, which has a good basis, once again, I'm not trying to denigrate our predecessors, still is considerably weakened here, because in jumping from one equilibrium point to another, from one which is mutually disadvantageous to one which we hope will be much better. We cannot go incrementally. That is the lesson, the main lesson here. Jumps are only big jumps. Jumps occur not by a little expansion in the automobile output of Great Britain, but by Great Britain taking over the hand calculator business from Germany, or vice versa. Now, these are all jumps which are not only big, but take us beyond the realm of current experience. We don't know how well Great Britain will do when it takes over the hand calculator industry, whether it will prove to be a superb success or a total failure. And here, being so far beyond the realm of experience, while it remains true that the bureaucrats cannot foresee what will happen, neither can the business people. Here we are all blind. Here we are all guessing. Here we are all taking leaps into the unknown. I can think of many other clichés, but the point is clear that we can now, in this situation, we are not in a position to say that the experienced business person knows and the bureaucrat does not, and that may well help to explain the experience of the tiger economies in the Far East, where government did choose which industries to help, because this story says it almost doesn't matter which industries you choose to help, as long as there is any reasonable likelihood that the country in which this is taking place can be turn out to be a reasonable producer of that commodity, and it is helped to attain the scale of operations necessary to compete successfully. So the end of the story is that we have here a new instrument of analysis which gives us theoretical insights built on the theoretical insights of our predecessors, but which, as one hopes, takes us one step further, and insights which offer us clearer views of issues in policy. I started off yesterday mentioning, for example, the failure of the received analysis to throw much light on the great debate over the North American free trade agreement. Yet this begins to grapple with such issues, because it tells us, yes, you are dealing with a relationship between Canada, USA, and Mexico. We are at that end of the graph, and that is an end of the graph which, unlike the middle, offers the possibility of mutual gains. I have taxed your patience long enough. I have lived on my ability, such as it is, to appeal to your intuition, and in doing so, have had to make leaps of logic and depend on your sense of heuristics. Tomorrow, when Ralph Gummery talks, we will take, I hope, a giant step towards showing the underpinnings of this analysis, toward bringing rigor where I have offered vague intuitions. So once more, I thank you, and I leave you with a subject that is to be continued.
thank you all very, very much.
Well, I'd like to thank on your behalf Will for a fascinating second lecture. I should advertise the technical seminar, which will be given by Dr. Ralph Gomery tomorrow afternoon at Thursday, 5th of May at 5:30 p.m. in the Center for Economic Performance Conference Room, which is on the fourth floor of the Lionel Robbins building. Everyone is welcome, but you're warned that a certain amount of mathematical baggage is best carried with you. I don't think, Will, I'd like though to let you go without asking the audience if they have any questions, either on today's or yesterday's lecture.
May I just interrupt one point, and that is to announce that various pieces of literature will be available, I guess, tomorrow or through your office, I am told,
sure.
So that if you haven't had enough of this over these 3 days, you can read the details and get even more pretty pictures than I have shown you today for your very own.
Right, so. Well, that also, I suspect, is for the aficionados. But now for the questioners. Yes.
Thank you. Well, I refuse to advertise myself as an instant expert on the economies of the Far East. They used to say that the typical Navajo family in the United States consists of 6 children, the parents, 1 grandparent, and 2 anthropologists. And the countries of Eastern Europe have now 2 economists, where the Navajo family has 2 anthropologists. But my instinct on that, and that's all I can claim, is that for the long run, free trade will indeed be will be mutually beneficial. That we are on either the right or the left-hand end of the region, whichever way you want to look at it, that if we can have a prosperous, militarily lazy former Soviet Union, we gain not only through the peace, but through mutual contributions to prosperity. Of course, that's long run. Where the rub comes in is how one gets from here to there, and the transition is obviously, we both know, extremely complicated and beset by pitfalls. And if we go straight at free trade without thinking about those, we are likely to make things worse. So my instinct, as I say, ill-informed though it is let's there move toward ultimate free trade, but think carefully of each step along the way. But the analysis, I think very strongly, bears the interpretation you've given it and strongly does suggest in the long run that we all have a great deal to gain from a prosperous Eastern Europe.
Well, but can I press you a bit? Because it all depends which pair you take, doesn't it? I mean, from your graphs, you would expect that Russia and Ukraine should be competitors, but Germany and the Ukraine, or Germany and Russia, could collaborate. I mean, so the answer to the question, is free trade a good thing? I mean, if from your graphs, is it depends which pair of countries you take?
Oh, absolutely, I agree. I was really thinking of Western Europe and the United States in its relation to Eastern Europe, thinking of them both as blocks rather than the individual countries. Yeah. Now, your point, of course, is absolutely
right. And the logic, surely, is that the, I mean, again, to take your graphs extrapolating a bit, is that trade might lead to yet further breakups.
I mean, yes.
The United Kingdom going into Europe might well be better advantaged if England and Scotland split up, because England and Scotland might win, whereas the UK United Kingdom might lose. And try that with Northern Ireland and Ireland and so on. I mean, so this, I mean, there's an interesting thing here, as it explained, as free trade moves out, even in countries like Europe, you'll actually atomize the nation states that go in.
That,
I mean, and try that on the US. But now, Christopher.
Well, I'd like to thank you for a most intoxicating cocktail of micro and macro economic elements. Mm-hmm. But we shall find out what ingredients went into it tomorrow, and we look forward to that. I'd like to say I also enjoyed your example, because I'm chairman of the Franco-British Council. You may not know that.
I did not.
I want to look at your middle region, because I think you spoke more about the outer regions. Now, I think you let slip that if you add together the GDP of the two countries, the joint GDP, I think you said reaches a maximum somewhere in the middle, where they each have a 50% share.
Not 50, but somewhere in the middle.
So this suggests that in the middle region, one country may be losing relatively, but it may still be gaining absolutely.
Absolutely.
If both GDPs go up enough. What I want to ask you is whether there is a cooperative scenario, even in the middle region, where it pays one country to transfer some of its industries to the other, so that they are colluding to achieve a maximum joint GDP. And in that case, the loser, the country which gives up some industries, could possibly afford to be compensated by the gainer. And you can imagine sort of foreign direct investment scenarios where this is actually happening.
The answer, that, you know, I'm really overwhelmed, because all of these comments have been so rich and suggestive. I'm sorry, but I had to say this for the director's comments, for yours. They're opening up ways of looking at these things that I hadn't thought of. What you're suggesting is indeed a possibility. That is, what it says is, without Caldorian compensation, that is the notion that if there is a change in which I gain 100 pounds and you lose 30 pounds, it's worth changing if afterwards I call you out in the hall and say, look, I'll give you 40, that still leaves me with a 60 pound gain. So what it means is that the central region really is a region of rivalry that can be avoided but only by very subtle means, by means which entail all sorts of devices in which the gainer, the country that moves uphill as you move in that graph, more than compensates the country that moves downhill in the graph. But there's no reason at all why, in a rational world, in ways that you hinted at, one should not be able to do that. Promise France a marketing campaign for
Camembert.
Chateau Yquem or...
Camembert.
Or Camembert. Yeah. Or whatever. So, yes, that is... That's.
We have to remit back to us the profits on the direct investment which we make there.
Yes.
It actually works through the market.
Yeah, fascinating idea.
Yeah. It's a bit like Sainsbury's opening a branch in Calais. Yes, go on.
Inefficiencies, that means there are unexploited gains from cooperation, and perhaps individual institutions, firms, could do it. Whereas in the discussion you emphasized, that the director emphasized, we're pretty glad to this. Is it impossible for such incentives in your model be provided even to individual companies?
It's not impossible, but it is very difficult. Remember, the characteristic of this analysis, a characteristic of much of reality, is the high startup costs of getting into particular industries. You can't just go in a little bit. There is no being a little pregnant. You cannot get into that activity marginally. And that means, and yet, where you're going is far outside your realm of experience. So you're required to take an enormous risk, that is both in the quantity of effort, the quantity of expenditure, the quantity of capital, the quantity of learning, for something about which you know very little. You've never had any experience in it. And that means that it's not impossible for very risk-prone business people to get together and leap in. But of course, if we're dealing with something very close to an externality, what economics says is, sure, leave it to the business people to carry out, but give them an incentive to do so. I'm not saying abandon the price system. But then the government still is intervening in this sense that it has to say, we will pick a few industries which we consider strategic because we can't do it all the way up and down the line. And this is, say, what South Korea did. Now, let me just say one other word on that. Why it is, this analysis says that choice is at least a little bit easier, that is the choice of which are the right industries, than we are habituated to thinking. Because in the game of industrial policy, it has been customary to think of looking for, quotes, winner industries. Those industries which will be wonderful in the future, and to abandonment of those which will do badly in the future, and of course, which ones will be which. I here use my line, I've used it here today before, is that the only thing about the future of which I am confident is that it will surprise me. You know, so... If you're looking for winner industries, that's a dangerous game. But what this analysis says is, don't worry too much about whether they are winners or losers. Look for retainable industries. Because if the industry you invest in, you get today, but it can be gone tomorrow, because anyone can invade it easily, that wasn't worth the effort. Pick those industries which are retainable, and those you can check from current data. You're asking which have high heart startup costs, which are not easy to invade, and those you can identify with some degree of confidence today. Obviously, you don't want industries that are about to vanish because, like buggies, no one wants them anymore, but any industry with a reasonable prospect that is also got reason to a reasonable degree the qualities of retainability becomes a good candidate, and that a bureaucrat can select. And that's why I believe that the Japanese and the Koreans, with bureaucrats, as we learn now in Japan, not wiser or with greater integrity than the rest of us are used to, have nevertheless apparently succeeded in picking the right industries. The answer is there aren't the right industries. Pick any small set of retainable industries, industries with high startup costs, and stick to them, and the payoff is there. It doesn't matter which ones you pick, as long as you pick those. The Japanese and the Koreans picked them not because they were retainable. I don't think that, I don't know, but I'm guessing it didn't enter the discussion. I suspect they picked them because they were high tech and sort of offered the chance of getting into the 20th century, but it happened that they also had the attribute of retainability. And this analysis tells you then at least one reason why they succeeded.
Well, looking at the clock, I think it's time we let you go. But just before we do, can I remind you all that there will be the technical seminar tomorrow. Coffee and biscuits will be available from 5:15 in the lobby, no extra charge, outside the conference room at the Center for Economic Performance. And finally, thanking on behalf of us all for a fascinating lecture, can I remind you that there is in fact promised, it's been somewhat delayed, but I think probably within the next 3 or 4 weeks, a white paper on competitiveness, on which Mr. Heseltine has been spending an inordinate amount of time, if Westminster and Whitehall rumour is to be believed, and it will be fascinating to see how it shapes up against this analysis. I mean, with a bit of luck, we might actually be able to slip him a copy of one of your papers. And, however, so that your lectures are most timely and have been appreciated by us all. I hope by Mr. Heseltine too. Thank you.
Thank you so much.